I'm Dylan Brody, humorist, storyteller. I'll be at Backstage at Barrels in Denver this Saturday, and I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, damn it. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am thrilled and delighted to be talking to a humorist, a comedy type person, a man who has written plays, a man who has been doing stand-up for many years. In fact, he's going to be at Denver, Colorado's Backstage at Barrels, which is a beautiful Jewishy name that I love. He himself is Jewish, which is even more exciting to me. His name is Dylan Brody. He's been on TV, he's been on stage, he's been on paper, and now he is on the old-fashioned telephone with us. Shalom, Dylan!
Shalom, damn it!
Shalom, damn it to you, too. So let me ask you, Dylan, what is your Hebrew name, first of all?
You know what? I only have a Hebrew name. My Hebrew name is Aaron, but I only have a Hebrew name because I am friends with a cantor who thought it was a Shonda that I hadn't won.
Well, what was when you were Brist and all that? What did they call you? Were Dylan then?
I was always Dylan. We are not a religious family. We are, I'm an atheist. I am so thoroughly an atheist.
Oh, God damn it! Why?
When people tell me they believe in God, I don't entirely believe them. It is deep in my structure, in my inner self, in the pithy middle of my epicore.
Oh, I've been there. It's frightening. Yes.
There's no sense to me of a deity in the universe. It's just how I function.
But what does the pithy center of your epicore believe in, and how did the world get here?
The pithy center of my epicore believes in the great vastness of possibility and the impossible power of time, that given an infinite space and an infinite time for in which it may exist, that all things are possible and all things will occur.
So like the monkeys and the typewriters.
Yeah, very much like the monkeys and the typewriters, except that I believe if the monkeys were given the typewriters, what they wrote would be more comprehensible than Shakespeare.
Ooh, or at the very least, the art of the deal, I would think.
That's right. Well, I believe that was created by a monkey with a typewriter.
But your Jewishness, Dylan Brody, even though you call yourself an atheist, has your Jewishness informed your writing and your comedy?
Oh, absolutely. I am certainly culturally Jewish.
What does that mean to you?
Well, my grandmother said to me when I was very young, she said, I was making a joke about something, and my mother, who can be a little bit tight sphinctered, said, Dylan, you don't make jokes about that, that's tragic. And my grandmother said, nonsense. We are Jews, we do not believe in tragedy. We believe in horror, atrocity, and injustice, and we know they are all hilarious.
Absolutely agreed. And by the way, agreed that your mother is tight sphinctered. I wrecked a couple of condoms in finding that out, but you know!
That's my new favorite story.
It's a beautiful story from your grandpa. Now, your grandpa figures heavily into your fictional book, Laughs Last.
Hey, that's not my grandpa in that book. That is a fictional grandpa. The grandfather in that book is the repository. And I always have to think before I say it, because if I say suppository, then I get off on a sidetrack.
Which would never fit in your mom's tuchus anyway, but yes.
We're spending way too much time in this call on my mom's tuchus.
I'm sorry, I have comedy Tourette's. I can't do that.
You've read my book.
I've read parts. Well, I haven't had the time to read the whole one. I will get to it. But
to hear somebody else say comedy Tourette's is just very thrilling to me. The grandfather in the book is the repository of everything I wish someone had taught me when I started doing stand-up comedy. The whole book grew up around a single piece of dialogue that sprung from my head full-blown like Athena while I was driving my car. There's this one moment in the book, and it's not too much of a spoiler because it's not actually the key moment in the book. It's just the one around which it grew, where the young comic, he's about 17 at the time, goes and visits his grandfather in the hospital. He's afraid his grandfather is dying, and he started doing stand-up comedy, the kid. And he says, you know, Papa, I'm doing stand-up. Do you think I can make a living at this? And Papa says, sure, you're a funny boy, Damon. And Damon says, I'm a man, Papa. And Papa says, you're not that funny. And in that moment of dialogue, I knew the whole relationship. And I could just build the book around that little exchange. And I so love both Damon and the grandfather that it was a joy to sit at my desk with them every day for the amount of time it took to write this thing.
Wow. Now, but again, it's not autobiographical, because we're going to get that
not.
Idea. Right.
It is very much a fiction. The family is a fiction. The boy is a fiction. I mean, Damon is much better at what he does than I ever was.
Oh. Well,
we get the sense that he makes a living at it. He does Letterman at one point in the book, which I never got to do. I write far more successful people than I am.
Welcome to the club, let me tell you.
Yeah, I understand.
Our synagogue is still in a garage, but let me ask you something here. You have done television. It's not as if you've never... You may not have done Letterman or perhaps
That's
Leonard.
Correct.
But you did you write for them, though? Did you ever write for one of the late 90s?
I wrote for Leno as a freelancer for much of the time that he was doing the Monday nights when Johnny Carson still did the rest of the week.
Oh, wow.
And Leno was the weekly guest host on Mondays. I was one of the freelancers. This was before people accepted submissions through email, so I was faxing in jokes to him. There's actually a story there. I was said the way it works is you'd send in, they wanted at least 50 jokes per submission, and I was trying to do, they wanted 50 written a day. I was generally doing 50 in a submission each week. And they kept not buying. I would send them in because I really wanted the credit. And then they bought the most innocuous joke I had written. I was writing a lot of political stuff, but they bought the most innocuous joke I had written that week.
What was
it? It was a dog in Sherman Oaks. A guard dog at a jewelry store had swallowed a ring worth $5,000. And it doesn't sound like a big deal, but you got to realize that's $35,000 in dog dollars. That was the joke.
That's funny. It's a funny joke.
It's a funny joke, but it's utterly innocuous. Utterly, you know. And they bought that. And I'm like, yes, I've gotten a joke on the Tonight Show. I'm a writer for them. This is very exciting. And then I kept submitting, and occasionally there were purchases. And then I got a message from his manager at the time, his now deceased manager at the time, on my phone machine saying, listen, we're trying to do a balanced monologue, a politically balanced monologue. If you're going to bash the right, we want you to bash the left just as much in your jokes. That was very uncomfortable for me. So I called her and I said, listen, I write from the left. I can't help it. It's who I am. It's the, you know, my belief structure. And I don't want to be writing jokes I don't believe in. And it would be very upsetting to me if I send you 50 jokes and 20 of them bash the right and 20 of them bash the left and the other 10 are innocuous and you use 5 of the ones that are bashing the left and suddenly I'm supporting ideas that I disagree with. Why don't you buy jokes from me and buy jokes from Jeff Wayne and you'll have a balanced monologue?
Right, exactly. But...
And she said, you know what, why don't you stop sending in then?
Oh!
So I had been fired from a freelancing job, which is already kind of weird.
Why was she such a, forgive the expression, cunt about this?
It's what she was known for. It's part of what she was known for.
Ooh.
So I stopped submitting, and this will date it exactly for you. You may or may not recall, I think you're a little younger than I, so you may not recall this, but Ross Perot was running for president, and he ran for president, and then he dropped out of the race. And then 2 months later, he got back into the race and went on to lose. So the day that she fired me from freelancing was, I don't know, 3 days after he dropped out of the race. And about 2 months later, I got a call, not from her, from someone else at Jay's staff, saying, hey, Perot is back in the race. Can we buy everything you ever wrote on Ross Perot?
Oh, well,
and
this,
I said, yes, except for this one joke that I'm using on stage.
what joke was that? I'm curious.
Is it just me, or when you put Ross Perot next to his running mate, Jim Stockdale, do they look exactly like the two guys he used to heckle from the balcony on The Muppet Show? And I had already, not only was I using it on stage, I was getting ready to do it on, I may have already taped it, I'm not sure, but I wound up doing it on Comedy on the Road with John Biner, and I didn't want there to be duplication.
Sure.
So I said, everything except that joke, and they said, fine, and I got this one final ridiculous check huge for my standards at that time from The Tonight Show, because they bought everything I had ever written on Ross Perot, and I don't know what of it they used, because I didn't care at that point. I just was happy to, they didn't tell you what they were using. You had to watch the show to find out which jokes they used.
Now, let me ask, did they keep all those files of your jokes, or did you have to send them again?
Oh, no, they had them.
That's nice. Oh, so they didn't just circular everything they didn't use. That's good.
Yeah, no.
So, but, again, you make it sound like you weren't particularly successful. You got a very nice check from that, I assume.
Yeah, I got a nice check from that. I've done, comedy on the road. I did Fox's Comedy Express, which was, I believe is just a locally broadcast show here in L.A. If I lived anywhere but in Los Angeles, I would be considered a successful writer and comic. But in Los Angeles, if your mortgage is in Sylmar instead of in the Hollywood Hills, and if you haven't made your first $4 million yet, you're considered a failure at 52.
Well, have you made your first $1 million yet?
No.
Okay, then welcome to the I'm still waiting for my first 10,000, let me tell you.
I understand. I've gotten that. I am a thousandaire. So I'm in the modern economy, I'm doing okay.
And you have a wife? What does she do?
I have a lovely wife whose name escapes me at the moment. She teaches kindergarten.
Oh.
And she adores the kids, and she gets no support from the world around her except me. Well, and I try to be as supportive as I can.
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, the educational system has been so poorly funded and so tied up in the idea of accountability for the last 26 years that a lot of the administrative energy goes toward judging as opposed to helping.
Hmm.
And this is not something that only she is aware of. It's anecdotal, and there hasn't been a study done as far as I know. But even in kindergarten with the tiny little kids, discipline and home support of the kids has been decreasing, partly because everybody's working two and three jobs, and partly because the stress is so great. She has five-year-olds cursing at her and punching her in class.
Whoa.
And that does not make it easy to teach numbers.
See, you have to be adaptable. It's like if a little kid hits her in the face four times, she goes, 1, 2, 3, 4 times. Four punches.
I like the way you think, sir.
Three purple bruises. 1, 2.
That's... You're doing the count from Sesame Street.
Three bruises.
Four visits from Children and Family Services.
Yeah, very good. We're talking, by the way, with Dylan Brody here in the neighborhood. He's going to be backstage at Beryl's. I don't know why they don't let you on stage there. You're pretty funny. But you can go backstage and see him at Beryl's in Denver tonight, Saturday, May 21st. You can also check out his website, dylanbrody.com. That's B-R-O-D-Y. So there's two Y's in his name. Were you named after Bob Dylan, by the way?
I was named after Dylan Thomas.
Oh!
Because my parents were hipsters when the only word for it was communist.
So they're voting for Bernie. Okay, we understand this.
Yes.
Are you?
Oh, yes. Until I have to choose between two people and one of them is not Bernie, I will be voting for Bernie.
I think that's fair. But once Hillary gets the delegates, I assume you'll stay Democrat.
Exactly right. I consider the orange one to be a great danger to the nation and humanity in general.
And humanity in general? Just because, why? Because he doesn't know what he wants to do yet, or...?
Well, no, because not only does he not know what he wants to do yet, he doesn't know things. and he is arrogant and narcissistic.
And, so am I.
Well, so am I, but I stick to things that I know. And when arrogant narcissists are out of their depth, they become reactive and unpredictable.
Okay.
They grasp for control wherever they may find it. In a national leader, this can take us directly down a path toward fascism very, very quickly. That concerns me greatly. Also, there are people that he's talked about rounding up, and I am not a big fan of the rounding up of people.
Wait a minute. I mean, people who enjoy light jazz,
they self-round up. They self-select. That's a very different kind of thing.
Fair enough.
We'll tell you this, though, and you may take joy in this. I don't know. I don't really know you, Rabbi.
You shouldn't.
I hate to predict your sources of pleasure on too little information. But if you want to enjoy listening to Trump's speeches, just imagine as he speaks that each speech is written by conservative douche nozzle David Mamet.
Okay.
If you listen to his speeches as Mamet monologues, they are damned entertaining.
Interesting. Okay. Political perversity in Chicago kind of a thing.
Oh, I am stealing that and using it.
Well, you may use it, but you must credit the rabbi. The hell is wrong with you? Don't you read the Talmud? You shouldn't steal.
I thought it didn't count if you said aloud, I am stealing that.
Well, you're saying it aloud to me now, but if you use it on stage, how are they going to know the Rebbe wrote it?
You make a lot of rules, Rabbi.
Well, you have that thing in the book where you have to, you're sort of the Zen person. If someone steals a joke, you let it go. If Carlos Mencia takes your act, it's all right, I'll write more. You believe that?
Yes, I will tell you a story. You got time for a story?
Of course I got time for a story. What else do I have to do? I'm a rabbi.
I will tell you a story. This is the story of Jimmy Brogan is the nicest man in the world and how I stopped hating a very famous comic whose name is redacted from this story.
Okay.
For legal reasons.
Ooh.
When I was 22, 23, I was the house MC at a club called Chrissy Francis' Hollywood Comedy Room here in L.A., as house MC, I took my job very, very seriously. I tried to not just be a host to the audience, but also a host to all the comics who were performing on any given evening. One of these people was Jimmy Brogan, who's a wonderful, funny comic who barely has an act. Most of what he does is, where are you from, what do you do for a living? He is charming. He's not an insult comic. Mm-hmm. He just deals directly with the audience throughout his act and converses, and is terrific. But every 6 months, he would go on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, which meant he needed to write an act. The first time he auditioned for the show, he went in and said to Macaulay, the booker, where are you from? And Macaulay said, what? I wanted to see your act. Macaulay said, this is my act. Where are you from? And Macaulay said, go write 6 minutes and come back. So every six months, he had to have 6 minutes of actual jokes. So he was coming in, he was working out his next 6 minutes, and he had a joke about supercuts. And he came off stage. There was a guy who used to hang out and try to sell jokes all the time. He tried to sell jokes, but he didn't know how to write jokes, so the jokes he wrote were terrible. He put his arm around you and said, you need jokes about supercuts, Jimmy? I got a joke for you about supercuts. How about this? I was short on cash 1 week, so I went into pretty good cuts. What do you think, Jimmy? Could you use that? Pretty good cuts. And I didn't want Jimmy to be accosted by this man, so I said, Jimmy, you need supercuts jokes? I got a supercuts joke. I steered him away from this guy.
Right.
And thanked him for coming in and doing the set, and was delighted to have him at the show. And he said, oh, that's very kind of you. What do you got on supercuts? And I said, I was just rescuing you from that schmuck.
Right.
And he said, oh, that's very nice of you. What do you got on supercuts? And I said, I actually have one supercuts joke, Jimmy, but I wasn't looking to sell it. He said, what do you got? I said, every time I go to supercuts for 2 or 3 weeks afterwards, all my friends walk up to me and go, hey, did you just take a nap? And he said, oh, that's pretty funny. How much you want for it? And I said, well, what does it pay? And he said, I'll give you $25 for it. Let me try it out for a week and see if it works. And a week later, he came back and gave me a check for $50.
Nice.
And I said, thank you, but you said 25. And he said, yeah, that was in case it didn't work, which was very sweet of him.
Very.
Very generous.
That's a mensch kind of a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Now, years later, I found out that a very famous comic had stolen a joke of mine. And I approached him outside the improv, and I said, hey, I hear you're doing one of my jokes. And he said, what's the joke? And I told him, when we had worked together that he would have heard me do it. And he said, when did you write it? And I said, 1985. And he said, 1984, it's my joke. From which I learned an important Hollywood lesson. Always let the other guy bid first. Now,
yeah,
I resented him for this for years. I told everyone about it. I named him on stage as having stolen this. I was just a jerk about it. And I became the guy who looks out for people stealing other people's material. I was like the corner man for a drug gang calling in when someone was stealing a joke. And I saw someone doing a joke of Will Schreiner's at a place called a now-defunct club called L.A. Cabaret. I called Will, and I said, hey, there's a kid on stage doing a bit of yours. Do you want me to talk to him? He said, no, what's the bit? And I told him the bit, and he said, okay. But don't you want me to do something? Do you want me to tell him to call you? He said, no. I said, well, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to write something new. Dylan, if he's stealing from me, he can't write.
Yes.
He needs the material. You and I can write. And And when he said it, the weight of this one stolen joke lifted off of me. I wrote something to fill that slot in my act instead of just telling the story of why I wasn't doing a joke that had been stolen from me. I had the freedom to know that creativity is an infinite natural resource. And I moved on with my life because I had to decide whether I wanted to be Will Schreiner or a resentful, miserable human. Then 2 years ago, I ran into Jimmy Brogan at a gig. And I said, hey, I owe you thanks. You got me started writing jokes for other people, and this is what happened. And do you mind if I tell this story about you on stage? He said, oh, no, no, that's very sweet. I'd forgotten. That's a great joke. I might start using that again. And I said, well, wait a minute. I thought I was going to start telling the story, and then I would be telling the joke on stage. And he said, that's fine. That's fine. Go ahead and do it. So the next day, I brought him $50. And he said, why are you giving me $50? I'm buying the joke back so that I can use it in the story. And he said, keep your $50, Dylan. I'm going to be telling the joke. So I still bought it. But I'm going to be telling the story on stage. With Dylan, if you tell the story and 2 months later someone hears me do the joke, that's just a great callback.
Mm.
And there was no jealousness about this. There was no sense of scarcity, even in the use of a single joke. And Jimmy, parenthetically, was the executive producer when Jay took over The Tonight Show. And Jimmy was the guy who got me the gig freelancing when Jay took over Monday Nights. So I believe...
Well, there's also karma. It's just basically good karma begets good karma, if you believe in that sort of thing.
But here's the thing. The problem with capitalism, and I've said this many times, is not unregulated, it becomes feudalism, although that is a problem. The problem with capitalism is that it relies on an untenable, erroneous notion, pre-industrial notion, of unlimited natural resources. And that doesn't exist. You can't have constant growth in manufacturing and constant growth in service and constant growth in everything unless there are unlimited natural resources. The only unlimited natural resource is creativity and the human capacity for adaptation.
Mm.
And that's the one we have to rely on.
But at the same time, would you say that sometimes there's jokes that are out there in the ozone or punchlines, and two writers could come up conceivably, independently, with virtually the same joke, especially if it's a topical thing.
Certainly.
So is it even possible that maybe that guy that you even thought who stole your joke, maybe he did write his version in 1984?
Oh, no, 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 no.
No.
If he had written it in 1984, then when we worked together in 1986 or 87, he would have seen me do the joke and gone, that's my joke, you can't do that.
Okay.
He saw me do the joke in 86 or 87 and then did it for years and years and years until I ran into him again. No, he actually stole it. I do believe in parallel creation, and I do believe that it happens all the time. But I also believe that there are thieves in the wild. And
Gunlips, we call them.
They can't write. Yeah, that's right. But they're thieves because they can't write or because they need something. And ultimately, thievery is an act of despair, not an act of malice.
Ooh. Usually, perhaps in creativity, yes. In creative terms, yes.
When we're talking about outright thievery as opposed to the banking system, I think it's frequently an act of one form of despair or another as opposed to an act of malice.
Now, since you bring up the word despair, Dylan Burney, you know something about this word and its many manifestations because you have, very openly, suffered with depression and have written about it, and written comedically about it and also seriously about it. So first of all, how you doing?
I'm fine. Last week was rough. My mood was spiraling downward like Larry Flint at the Guggenheim. But but this week it's a little better.
Now, wait a minute. Now, you're on medication, right?
Oh,
so shouldn't that keep you on an even keel all the time?
No. I'm not on lithium. No, I have moods and I have sadni. That's the Latin plural of sadness. And I have difficult weeks and I have good weeks. What I don't have is the constant certainty that nothing I do will ever improve the world or my life. Without the medication, I was 80% of the time deeply despondent. With the medication, 60% of the time, I am somewhat despondent.
Well, wait. Do you know what... there's actually a term for being despondent 90% of the time. It's called being Jewish.
I have difficulty. As soon as things start to break down into stereotype, I get very uncomfortable with it.
Okay.
I have to watch it, even in myself, because I am so concerned with the breaking and the loss of stereotype. I pick up every check because I don't want to be perceived as the money-hungry Jew, which I understand intellectually is just another way of being ruled by a stereotype, and still, I would rather be ruled by it to the end of breaking it as opposed to supporting it and maintaining a stereotype.
I completely understand why I like to reverse stereotypes. Like, I like being known as the large penis Jew.
According to my mother, whose sphincter is bruised... It's a callback, Rabbi! I did a 30-minute callback on your radio show, sir.
That's why you're a playwright, because, you know, you drop something in the first act, you mention it in act two, and people go, aha, there you go. That's
right. He knows what he's doing, for the love
But let me ask you something. Why didn't Prozac work for you, but Paxil does?
Different chemicals.
Okay.
It's just different chemicals. For me, Prozac almost caused me to kill a person.
There's got to be a story behind that.
Well, sure. I didn't realize until afterwards how much it had almost caused me to kill a person. I was on Prozac for 3 days, and I had. There's a piece of information about me that you may or may not know, which is that I am a Taekwondo master and a Hapkido instructor. I have a lot of martial arts training.
For me, Judo is what goes into a bagel, so...
Nice.
That is not original. That is stolen from... That is one of those jokes that's out there. Somebody wrote 40 years ago. I'm just grabbing it because it was there. But anyway...
Fair enough. I understand that. That's the comedy Tourette's.
Exactly.
That's the comedy Tourette's, sir. So I was studying martial arts, and at this point I was teaching at the studio, and I was teaching a Hapkido class for adults. I don't teach kids because I don't like children. My mother says I get that from her. I was teaching at the studio, and I was 3 days on Prozac, and a young man, 19 or 20, I was in my late 40s at this, or mid-40s at this time, he was 19 or 20, and he was making noise, doing his own training thing with a friend, another part of the studio, and I was having trouble focusing, and I asked him to keep it down, and he said yes, and then went back to making noise, and I asked him to keep it down again, and he got in my face and was very disrespectful, and as he was yelling at me in front of the class that I was teaching.
Oh.
All I could do was focus on my breathing to keep from killing him. I wanted to hit him, and I knew that was inappropriate, and I just kept focusing on my breathing until he walked away, and then I went on with teaching class, and on the way home, I called the pharmacy, and I said, okay, I've been on Prozac for 3 days, and I just had an emotional rage reaction that I've never felt before in my life, and they said, oh, stop taking it. We usually don't get this call until someone has put someone else through a wall.
On Prozac, I thought Prozac made everybody mellow.
For some people it does, but for some people not so much. And I said, well, you might want to put that in the black label contraindications. Do not take when interacting with humans. And she said, no, seriously, you just stop taking it and talk to your guy tomorrow. And so I called my psychiatrist the next day and said, okay, they told me to stop taking it. And he said, okay, let's try something else. And they put me on Paxil, and it worked beautifully.
Did you try Klonopin? Apparently that makes people feel really happy.
I have never tried Klonopin. I have never needed to because so far the Paxil works. If the Paxil ever stops working, then I'll go back to a psychiatrist and I'll say, all right, I know this feeling of misery and we need to try something else. 8 months after I went on the Paxil, the psychiatrist said, so should we try weaning you off? And I said, sure. And we cut back by a quarter of a pill. And I was driving to a meeting, and on the way I was figuring out what I was going to be angry about when I got there.
Oh, my God.
And I remember this for my whole life, this internal monologue about, okay, when I arrive, I'll be pissed off about the traffic that I had to face, and they better not make me pay for parking. I'm not going to a meeting where I'm going to have to pay for parking. And like, all these things going on in my head. And I got there early, because I get everywhere early, and the traffic had not hindered me at all that I was trying to complain about, and I found a parking space very easily. And I called my psychiatrist. I said, okay, so I cut down by a quarter of a pill, and I can feel all the darkness on the planet gathering at the base of my spine and clawing its way into the crevices in my brain. Does that make any sense? And he said, wow. And you say this was your first bout of depression we were treating you for? And I said, what? No. I've been depressed my whole life. And he said, stay on it. Apparently it works for you. Stay on it. And I went back up to the full dose, and it's done me ever since.
Mit Mazel, mit Glück. Now, one of the things that you've said is, even though you were not even remotely close friends, even though you were just acquaintances, you had a glancing semi-friendship with Robin Williams. And yet,
yes.
Was it because he was depressed that his suicide hit you so hard?
It was. And so there was also, there was another thing that hit me with that that was very difficult for me. Yes, it was because he was one of my heroes when I was coming up in the comedy world. And it was because I identified with him so strongly. He was also a classically trained actor whose love of comedy was beyond entertainment and thought of it as an art, as do I. And thank you, by the way, for saying we were acquaintances, not friends. I've had to start many interviews by saying, no, Robin and I weren't friends. We worked together once. And then the interviewers quickly lose interest in me because...
Oh, because they want to hear you and Robin Williams chumming around together and taking mutual belts and hanging yourself.
Exactly.
No, but, yeah.
Exactly. So that was part of it. I had a humor book that I'm going to be re-releasing as an e-book very soon called The Modern Depression Guidebook. That was being put out by a company called Authorium, and they were doing a big re-release of it. The same month that it was re-released, Robin took his life. And as a result, people were Googling Robin Williams in depression. And because Robin had given me a blurb for my writing, and I mentioned him on my website, and I had the book coming out, Robin Williams' depression kept leading people to me.
Well.
And I kept getting these calls from radio stations saying, hey, we want to talk to you about Robin Williams and depression. We understand you're a friend of his. And then I would have to disappoint them by not being his friend. And it was causing a spike in book sales.
Hmm.
And I had this incredibly disheartening phone call with my manager and my PR guy, in which my manager was saying, this is an opportunity, Dylan. We can use this and get you a lot of book sales.
If you make believe that you knew him better than you knew him?
And it was saying, yeah, but then I'm one of Hollywood's little Satanistas, and I don't want to do that. And the PR guy, who understood both sides of this, said, Dylan, you're trying not to sabotage your career anymore. Your manager is right that this is an opportunity. I understand what you're worried about. Here's what we're going to do. I will oversell your relationship with Robin. You get on the phone, clarify that, and steer every conversation to the need for mental health availability. And I will make sure that the people you're talking to mention the book. You never mention it at all. You are not using him to sell your book. They are selling your book. You are talking about mental health. And I said, okay, I'm willing to try this.
And
the phone call started happening, and I started to hate myself. So I called Authorium in London, that was where the company was, and I said, listen, I want you to take all of my profits for this month and next month while we're having this spike and give them to some mental health charity. And they said, there's a group called mind.org.uk that we've worked with before on something. We will do our profits as well. We understand. I said, great.
Whoa.
And I called my manager and I said, listen, I know this is going to cost you some money, but we're seeing a real spike in books because of Robin's death, and it's killing me. I'm giving all the profits to mind.org.uk. And he said, oh, that's a brilliant marketing scheme. And I said, you are fired.
Oh, no. Well.
So I work with I still have the same PR guy, but that manager is long gone now.
I'm sure as soon as he hung up with you, he went on Paxil, for crying out loud.
I hope so.
You know, they've got to think the way they think. I mean, even you, the human brain works the way it works. So when people started calling you about Robin Williams, you had to start thinking, well, I could use this for my career, but I shouldn't. But it's in your head that you potentially could, and it could give you a boost. You don't like it, but it could. You know, you can't necessarily blame a manager for thinking the way a manager thinks.
I cannot, but I can make sure that my team is not functioning in a way that I consider unethical or immoral. I would rather lose some potential income than be under the advisement of somebody who thinks that that's a valid way to do business.
See, now, I would do anything for money.
I can't think that.
I would blow a football team for money, let me tell you.
I didn't say I wouldn't blow a football team.
Okay, go ahead. Well, indoor football. Outdoors.
Okay, fair enough.
Those guys are too big. But you know, talking with Dylan Brody here in the neighborhood on Dave's Gone By with me, Rabbi Sol Solon. But here's another thought. You were really upset about the death of Robin Williams because of what he represented and how much he meant to you as a performer, as a playwright, as a writer. But I think, did you know more personally George Carlin? And when he went, did that upset you as much? Or, well, he was old, he had, did a lot of drugs in his life, and therefore he died.
I was very upset when he died.
Oh, okay.
Again, I did not know him well. We spoke on the phone a couple of times, and he was incredibly supportive and kind to me in those phone calls. I wrote about the phone... I didn't write about the effect his death had on me, though it did. But at that moment... when he died, I was in the middle of some other things going on in my life that had me a little more inner focused than I was when Robin died. I am now very good friends with George's daughter, Kelly. Oh,
she was on. I interviewed her. She was on the show last year.
She is a wonderful human.
Very nice lady, yes.
And a very dear friend of mine. The extent to which George's death affected me is not nearly as deep as the extent to which his daughter's friendship affects me.
Oh.
Because she is really in my life in a way, and in a way that is more important than any kind of celebrity worship. And there was a similar thing when Gary Shandling died a month or so ago, where I had had brief interactions with him. I sort of knew him. We had some friction. We had some makeup. Then he was gone.
Why did you have friction with Gary Shandling?
Because my career consists largely of alienating people of ever-increasing power in the industry.
Welcome to my life, yes.
We had met through Twitter. We were playing a lot of top that line kind of jokes on Twitter, and we were playing games there, and we were talking, and he was calling himself Uncle Gary, and I asked him for lunch, and he said, yes, so you can take me out to lunch. And then I pushed, and finally, after a year and a half, he agreed. And on the day I was going out to lunch with him, I tweeted, meeting at Universal and then lunch with Gary Shandling doesn't suck to be me. And within an hour, someone who was working as my social media maven at the time posted, Dylan Brody's doing this big show on Saturday. Hey, Gary Shandling, how about a retweet? And to Gary, who was a very private man, it felt as though I was trading on his name. And by the time he arrived at lunch, he was furious.
Oh, my gosh.
So the first 20 minutes of lunch were Gary Shandling, comedy icon, scolding me. So, containment, Dylan. Don't tell people on Twitter you're going to lunch with me. You don't know who I lied to and said I couldn't have a meeting because I'm sick. You don't know. And we're not going to be friends now, Dylan. You understand? No more Uncle Gary stuff. And this went on for 20 minutes until finally I said, okay, now it's my turn to talk.
Ooh.
I apologized four times for this. I'm done apologizing for it. You're one of my heroes. You allowed me, when I saw your work, to become more authentically myself and to really approach comedy in a different way. I am glad I'm having lunch with you. And can we stop now harping over the fact that there were two tweets in the world of under 140 characters each that bothered you? And then he lightened up a little bit, and we talked for an hour and a half about comedy and boxing. He was a boxer and taekwondo, which is, you know, one of my styles.
Oh, there we go, yeah.
And then we left. And 3 weeks later, I saw him at Kelly's event, actually, at the very first preview of Kelly's show, Carlin Home Companion. He smiled at me, and I couldn't tell if it was a forced smile or if I was projecting that. And a photographer said, can I get a photo of you two together? And I said, sure. Kat Gwynn, a terrific photographer, took a shot of us. As soon as I got to my car, I went to my phone and I sent him an email that said, hey, ordinarily I would put this right up on Facebook, but I don't want to mess with your sense of containment. Is it okay? And he said, absolutely put it up, pal, which made me realize that when men say pal in an email, it is an indication of closeness. And when women say pal, it is an indication of how close you're not going to get. And then about a month later, I got an email from him that said, hey, Dylan, I thought you should have my phone number, and then his phone number, and then don't ever use that.
Okay.
And I didn't know what that meant, so I sent him an email back that said, thanks so much, this is my phone number, you can use it anytime you want. And then we never spoke again, and then he died.
Well, okay, it was a difficult...
So it was friction, and then it was not, and then it was, and he was a difficult man, I'm told, in many, many ways. And to me, he was very kind, and then he was difficult, and then he was kind again.
But also, obviously, brilliant. I mean, two of the best sitcoms in cable history were courtesy of him. In specific ways, what are one or two comedians that you learned from and that have influenced directly what you do on stage or on paper?
Do you mean that I learned from personally or that I learned from watching?
Even seeing on TV when you were growing up. Someone of style or the patter or the rhythm, whatever it is.
Well, Lord Buckley.
Lord, you're kidding me, really?
An important figure in my career, yes.
Wow, bibbidi-bibbidi-bop. Yeah, how is that?
Paul Prevenza once described what I do as treating comedy as literature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much what Lord Buckley did. He treated literature as a source for comedy. There are times that I do that as well in all sorts of different ways. So my love of language and rhythm and the lyricism of comedy largely comes from Lord Buckley. George Carlin, when I was a kid,
sure.
I adored, memorized and learned and loved. So there was all of that. I mean, when I was a kid, David Steinberg and Dick Cavett and all the guys who made intellectualism okay, and Woody Allen. And by the way, I've been working on a Woody Allen impression. It's very much the same as my Henry Winkler impression, only less reverse home mortgage and a lot more alleged pedophilia.
Alleged, yes.
I just got back from London where I was accepting the Lewis Carroll Award for overly avuncular behavior.
That's good.
I don't want to say that my date for the event was young, but she was wearing a lacy training bra from Victoria's Can You Keep a Secret collection.
That's good.
And for the record, I feel that Bill Cosby is innocent. If he were any more innocent, I would find him very attractive.
Thank you, Reverend. That is good. Let me ask you, do you feel guilty about doing Woody Allen jokes in case he's innocent?
No. I love Woody Allen. I love Woody Allen's work from early on. I don't for a second believe he's innocent.
Whoa. I mean, not marrying Sun Yi, but you mean with the other kid? Do you think?
Yeah, I don't believe that he's innocent. I think we have a habit of trusting celebrity over anything. I think if it were not a celebrity's kid, it would have been investigated more thoroughly. It would have been handled very differently. And I don't for a second think he's innocent. And and Manhattan reads now as a confession. There are a bunch of little one-liners in a bunch of his films that also read as confession. I know about my odd, shameful fetishes and how I keep confessing them through my work.
Oh, tell me. What are some?
There's just the one. I am deeply attracted to disabled women, amputees in particular.
All right. Is there a name for this?
Yes, it's acrotomophilia, I believe. It's a paraphilia, and it's not all that uncommon, and it's been with me since at least second grade. It already felt like old traveled territory in my brain by then.
Wait. That must have been an instance. You saw a woman in a wheelchair, and you thought, ooh.
I cannot track it to a particular instance. You know, I've spent a lot of time in therapy talking about it and trying to figure it out, and it doesn't matter. Because, as one therapist said, I said I wouldn't be bothered by it if it didn't come with so much shame. And she said if it didn't come with shame, it wouldn't be a fetish. It would just be something you're into. And I try to talk about it as though there is no shame because I want people to know that whatever their dark shames are, they only hold real power as long as you treat them as shameful.
And also, I mean, quite honestly, it's a perfectly harmless... You're with someone who's paralyzed, and you like burning cigarettes on their legs. It's the one person that you can do that to.
On the one hand, that's true. But it's also... And yet there is the sense that I am taking pleasure in someone else's trauma or, as my grandmother would disagree with me, tragedy. There is the sense that I'm... that I'm getting off on somebody else's trouble, which is not exactly how it works, but I get that and I feel it and I understand.
Yeah, you're getting off on someone else's stumps, but you know, I can't. But your wife is fully functioning.
My wife has all her original parts.
Right, in working order.
Yeah, I've always said that her physical perfection is her only flaw.
So does she? She must know if you're open about these things.
She does.
Does she indulge? Does she make believe she's?
No,
on crutches.
When we first met, there was some of that, and then she lost interest in that. But And while I'm happy to talk about my personal stuff, I would rather not get into stuff that includes my wife.
That's fair.
Is a wholly private person. It is the nature of her privacy that led me to write the joke, my wife, whose name escapes me at the moment.
It's a really great line. That's what I wonder about, if you have a fetish that is kind of going in. You're not ashamed of it, but it's in the closet because you can't indulge it with the person you're married to.
It's deeply unsatisfied most of the time.
I can imagine. What, do you have any other... I'm not going to judge. I'm just curious.
No, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
That's pretty much it. But my point is, and there are a number of stories in which it comes up in one way or another, and it keeps coming up in my script.
Quite literally, yeah.
Yes. When I see those references in Woody Allen's work, I go, he's he knows and he's trying to tell us. No, and the jokes that I do, I say alleged most of the time, because I'm aware that there's no criminal case against him, but I also think there's a reason he's so frequently more comfortable living abroad.
With Roman Polanski.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it ain't easy being Woody.
Okay.
But well, what I was really saying is that he was a big influence on me when I was starting out. His voice and his rhythms and his Jewishness very much told me that I was okay in a way that I didn't feel.
He was a matinee. I mean, the beauty of him in the 1970s was he wasn't just the funny guy. He was the leading man hero, getting people like Charlotte Rampling and Diane Keaton.
Exactly.
And, all right, well, Louise Lasser, too. But besides her, you know?
And, did I love Diane Keaton.
Oh, we all still do. Well, yeah, come on. I mean, shiksa, but what can you do?
And then in the modern world of comedy, you know, I love everything that Paul Provenza is doing, not as a performer, he's a wonderful performer, but in terms of expanding the boundaries of comedy on television and the exploration of comedy as an art form with his book Satiristas and The Green Room on Showtime when that was on, and now supporting Troy Conrad's show Setlist. That he's done some terrific work that's been influential to me in the way I think about comedy in the world.
And I think also he and you are closer to friends.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I am very fond of Paul. Brendan Byrne, an Australian comic who now lives in England, is stunning. I love watching everything he does. Jim Jeffries as well. There are a lot of comics right now. Patton Oswalt.
Poor guy. What the hell happened with his... Do you know him at all other than seeing him on TV?
I've met him once, I think.
Okay.
I don't know him well, but I can watch him forever. Him, Maria Bamford, Jackie Cation. These are people whose work is incredibly meaningful to me in the way that they are just absolutely authentically themselves on stage and let us in to the strangeness of their own humanity.
Ooh, I may steal that line.
Go right ahead.
Just for Talmud class, not actually in
whatever you want.
Oh, thank you. That's very, very kind of you. Can I ask you, what in your life, not really going back to depression, but more like despair, what brings you more despair, stand-up comedy or playwriting?
Oh, playwriting.
Yeah.
Playwriting, screenwriting. There's so much more immediate rejection and lingering rejection in screenwriting. As a performer, and I now think of myself as a humorist and storyteller, not a comic, but as a performer, you go on stage and there may be a line here and there that doesn't get a laugh, but you've got the job and you're getting paid and people are responding to the work. With playwriting, you send it out and you hear back, you know, 5 or 6 months later, no.
Yes.
And that hurts every time. And then as a screenwriter and a television writer in Los Angeles, it's even more difficult because in Los Angeles, yes plus time equals no. So
yeah.
you think people are responding to the work because they never say no thank you. And then things just drag on until you realize you have to get onto something else because nothing is happening.
Yeah, and until half the people you were dealing with have been fired or moved to a different studio.
Exactly. It's very difficult.
But you make a living. I mean, obviously, your wife, she teaches, that helps. But you are able to make an okay living from what?
I cobble it together. You know, I perform wherever I can, whenever I can. David Sedaris has me open for him now for the last 3 years when he's on the West Coast.
Oh, nice.
So that's opened up a whole new audience to me. I do commentary for KPCC, which is a local NPR station, on a show called Off Ramp. I get residuals on, I guess, the royalties on the CDs and the airplay of the CDs. I get royalties from the books. And at the same time, last year I wrote a whole bunch of episodes for a preschooler's animated series. I'm currently looking to get a job writing a television series that I'm going to be meeting about later this month.
Oh, with Mazel. Or I shouldn't say with. I hope you have Mazel. Yeah.
Yeah, it's there's always something going on that is a freelance job that's paying me a chunk of money, and then a bunch of little jobs that are paying me little bits of money. All the while, I'm constantly redefining success in my own terms, so that I don't feel like I'm a failure because my career doesn't look like what I imagined it was going to look like when I was young.
If you're eating, if you got a roof over your head, and spending your days creating art and comedy, does it get better? I mean, really?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Wait, you're saying it does get better, or you're saying it's...
It could be better, and it just keeps getting better.
Oh.
I live in a house, in a townhouse that I'm paying a mortgage on with a wife that I adore and two dogs and a turtle. How could it be bad?
Well, the turtle, I don't know. That turtles are annoying. But
Shel Turtlestein is a wonderful creature.
Is that really his name, Shel Turtlestein?
Well, it's actually Sheldon Maurice Turtlestein Brody, but yes, Shel Turtlestein.
Actually, you should have called it Saul Turtletaub. He was a real writer.
We have been told we should have called it Turtletaub, but we don't. We call it Sheldon Maurice Turtlestein Brody.
We are talking not with Shell, but with Dylan Brody here in the neighborhood, reminding you that tonight he's going to be in Denver at Backstage at Barrels. That is a club. He'll be performing. Plus, if they go to your website, dylanbrody.com, can they buy the CDs? Can people, is that like the hub where people can spend money on you?
Click at the Emporium. An emporium of fine words and phrases at my website, and they can buy the CDs, they can buy the books, they can buy books that I have a poem in here and there, they can buy books that I have a story in here and there, and they can buy all of my novels and my CDs and digital downloads from Rooftop Comedy.
Wow, so it really is the hub for all things Dylan Brody-esque, as it were.
So they can also get on my newsletter there and always know where I'm going to be and what I'm doing.
Last question for the very, very fun, very smart, Dylan, and very honest Dylan Brody. I've lost my place on the thing. Hold on.
Happens to the best of us.
What the hell was my question going to be? Oh, yeah.
I don't remember.
See how we were talking about you lay the Easter egg in the first act and you get back to it in the second or
yes.
You know, that thing? So, twice we have mentioned the idea of comedy Tourette's, but we've never actually explained it. So, for people out there, what do you mean by that?
It's a term I coined years ago and use in the novel Laughs Last, available at Amazon.com and DylanBrody.com. There's a thing that has happened to me my whole life. It's improved marginally with age and self-confidence. But it is the ability to hear in the middle of conversation the setup that requires a punchline. In much the way that in Framing Roger Rabbit, a toon cannot hear the first half of Shave and Haircut without responding two bits.
Yeah.
It is almost a reflexive tick to blurt out the punchline when one feels it, when one hears it in their head, in his or her head. So that, for instance, having worked for Steve Allen many years ago, I cannot hear somebody say I stand corrected without responding I'm wearing orthopedic shoes. I can't hear I for one without saying and T for two. I have a bunch of these sort of stored up, but also there are things where I'll hear the setup when it's not actually a setup. I will just write the punchline in real time, and it will blurt out of my big stupid face.
Oh.
Which is great if I'm on stage and I'm performing, or if I'm in a meeting, or if I'm doing a radio interview where I'm expected to be funny and charming, and the guy who's always incredibly witty.
Right.
At a funeral, not so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was a time when I could not even control it there.
Oh, I know the feeling. Believe me. Yes. What was the most embarrassing incident or moment where it was in your head, you had to say it?
Yeah. I was working on a film in 1986 called Rented Lips that Martin Mull wrote.
Oh.
I was on at the rap party. I had a very small part in the film. I didn't have lines. I was an extra, but I was an extra who was on through the whole film because I had to be in the background all the damn time. And at the rap party, there was sort of a talent show for all the people in the cast who had talents that they didn't get to show off in the film. So a whole bunch of my heroes were in the room. It was Martin Mull and Dick Shawn and Shelley Berman,
wow.
Kenneth Mars.
Well, half the cast of the producers is there, okay.
Yeah, exactly. It was that kind of a movie. Robert Downey Jr. was in it. Robert Downey Sr., who did Putney Swope,
right,
was directing it. And Jennifer Tilly was in it. And no one had ever heard of... Downey had done maybe one or two movies. Junior had done one or two movies, maybe, but was not a household name. And Jennifer Tilly certainly wasn't yet. So I was performing a set that was not going well. Jennifer Tilly started to wander on stage, and I said, "Oh, ladies and gentlemen, it's the lovely Meg Tilly's sister."
All right.
And
yeah.
And it was so inappropriate and wrongheaded. I saw her just stop short. And a few moments later, they turned off the microphone and turned on the music. It was not the best show I've ever done. And Shelley Berman went down in flames. And then a woman who was in the film, who was also a snake dancer, couldn't get anybody's attention. And then Martin tried to shut down the show. And I said, "But you promised me stage time." So he put me on stage. He figured out that it wasn't going to work before I did.
Yeah.
I was young and on cocaine and self-confident. It was a horrible, embarrassing evening in many ways. But that particular line... Oh, another one was... I was on stage... this hurts. I was on stage at someplace on the East Coast when I was a young comic, and I was heckled from the right side of the stage, and I turned to take on the heckler, and it was a morbidly obese woman. And I froze up because I didn't want to be going after the fat lady.
Okay.
And
good.
I said... "You know what, ma'am, I want to, but I can't. So here's the thing. I'll be back next year. Diet, come back, heckle me, we'll do this."
Oh, that's great.
The audience started to stiffen.
Oh.
And I turned to go back to my set, and she shouted, "Oh, so it's over now?" And I said, "It ain't over till you sing."
I mean, okay, that's very mean, but she was heckling.
Yes, but I could not win the audience back after that.
Oh.
And
oh.
I don't like to be that mean.
Mm. I do.
You know.
I am whenever I can. Mean and violent. Yeah.
I have a dear friend who's a comic who's mean, who enjoys the mean, and I just don't do it.
But again, she started it. You finished it. So,
yes.
Fair's fair.
Yeah, I suppose.
So, I said that was the last question, but then you mentioned that you worked for Steve Allen. And
yes.
I have to ask, where I know this. What did you do for him? What was he like?
I was, in 1993, 94, I was his transcriptionist. He walked around all the time with a little pocket recorder.
Yeah.
And I took the pocket, or the micro cassettes, and typed whatever he had said, and then divided up the notes between the appropriate people in his office. So people who needed to get a copy of a book that he had met, he had talked their address into the thing and said, "Send them a copy of Dump, have me sign it." I would send that to his personal assistant, and then the office manager would get things that needed to be mailed out, and then the music transcriptionist would get songs that he had diddled on the piano that he needed to transcribe, and so on. So my job was transcribing stuff. And at that point, he was crazy and angry and aging and sad. I met Carl Reiner two or three years ago, when he gave me the blurb for my book. And I said to Carl that it was a delight to meet one of my heroes and not be disappointed. And like anyone else would, he said, "Oh, who disappointed you?" And I told him about working for Steve Allen, who had been the first person to make me laugh aloud at the television. And he told me that Steve, when he was young, was a sweetheart of a man, that Steve had produced the first 2,000-year-old man album and taken no part of it. He had just heard them do it at a party and said, you got to put this on a record. I'll produce it for you. It's all yours. And then Carl Reiner, 2 years ago, said to me, yeah, I forgot when he got old, he got angry and crazy. Boy, I hope when I get old, I'm not angry and crazy.
And I have to tell you, I had the pleasure of interviewing Carl Reiner a couple of years ago, and he was not angry, and he was not crazy.
No.
He was wonderful. He talked about it. And he was still sort of in mourning for his wife, and he was still honest and lovely, and what a sweetheart.
Such a sweet man.
I'm kind of sorry I asked about Steve Allen, but not about Carl Reiner.
I got to it anyway.
Did you get to see the big, the storage room of all his archives and things? That sounded really cool.
Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah.
Not only did I see it, he had an archivist who worked in that room, and I had him, this was in the days of VHS, it was before everyone had a DVD player and a computer that could burn them, I had him make me a VHS of all of both of Lenny Bruce's appearances on the Steve Allen Show, and I treasured it for many years. I have no idea where that tape is now.
Oh, well, you know what, the material's probably on YouTube somewhere.
I think it is now, probably.
Well, anywho, there is tons of material to see of Dylan Brody on his website, dylanbrody.com, things you can buy, his CDs, his books, and also go see him tonight live at Backstage at Barrels in Denver, Colorado. Dylan, I want to thank you ever so much for being so honest and funny and smart and delightful on the Dave's Gone By radio program. I wish you more years of humor and wit and not meanness. Although, if you start crawling your way back towards Judaism, I am here to help you.
You're a very sweet man. Thanks.
No, I'm not, but I'll do that for you.
All right, thanks.
Thank you again. Shalom to you.
Talk to you soon. Take care, man.
Bye-bye.